Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll talk about the hike in food prices and why people throw out more than a quarter of the food that is produced in just a minute. Just let me remind you of the phone number and the web address. I'll just take 30 seconds to do this right now. Just for people just tuning on their radios, just so you know that our membership drive ends on Thursday. And for those of you who value WNYC as an independent, not-for-profit, freestanding news organization and cultural institution, we hope you'll make that once-a-year tax-deductible contribution to keep us going. 1-888-376-WNYC is the number to call, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. Thanks, everybody, for considering it, as the drive will end in just 2 days. Well, maybe you take the train across town now just to go to a good price market to save money. But here's another money-saving tip. Have you taken a look at the food that you're tossing out? A new government study says 27% of food is thrown away. That's about 1 pound per person every day. And while the money crunch may have consumers scaling back, when it comes to food, we might all benefit from less, whether or not we can afford to buy more. New York Times business reporter Andrew Martin has been writing about this issue. And Andrew, welcome to WNYC today.
Brian, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. Now, why do restaurants and grocery stores throw things away in the first place?
Well, I think somebody I quoted in my story said it's the path of least resistance. You know, I mean, there's concerns about whether it'll make people sick. You have to sort of arrange for people to come and get it, and you know, it's easier to just toss it, I think.
The federal study, what types of food did the survey look at? And what did it leave out?
Well, you know, it's sort of obvious. I mean, the stuff that gets thrown out the most is stuff that spoils easily. So dairy is huge, fruits and vegetables, things like that. The study is actually, they're in the process of updating it. So the information's a bit dated, but you know, one of the questions I had was, you know, has anything changed since you sort of looked at this in the late 90s? And it's sort of hard to say. There's not great data on this, to be honest. It's a hard thing to measure, but you know, the fact is that the people that run landfills say that food is the biggest source of the waste stream by weight, so it's still a major problem.
I guess the real question here is, what's the likelihood of coming up with any policies on our unwasted food if we start wasting less, either as individuals or businesses, of that unwasted food getting redistributed so as to curb the global food shortage or bring down the price for anybody? Is that possible?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people have tried this before, and it hasn't worked very well. But, you know, the fact is, even if people made little changes, it does have an impact. I think in that study that I quoted, you know, said if 5% of the food that gets tossed was not thrown out, you know, it'd feed 4 million people. And obviously not all the food we throw out is somebody can eat. But people are doing some sort of interesting things around the country that make sense and are fairly easy to do. Like at colleges, you know, when I went to college, you'd get a tray and you'd load it up with as much as you could get on it, and then you'd throw half of it out. And now a lot of colleges are going to trayless systems where you got to sort of carry it in your hand, which is, you know, when you think about it, it's like, why didn't they think about that 20 years ago? It's so obvious. And in San Francisco, you know, it's San Francisco, and they, you know, they've come up with this system for composting garbage that doesn't get thrown out. So, you know, and they generate like 300 tons of compost a day just from composting food waste. So, you know, and it's easy to sort of say, well, that's San Francisco. And but, you know, the fact is they've set up a garbage system that creates incentives for restaurants to put this aside and put it in composting. So it's not really that difficult to do.
I wonder if there's almost a natural economic cycle here, which is when food was cheap, relatively cheap in this country, then throwing it out was, as you called it, the path of least resistance. Now, since everything's getting more expensive, then there's going to be more pressure on both individuals and businesses to conserve more with things like trayless meals and dorm cafeterias and, you know, and all kinds of other things because now we have to.
Exactly. And, you know, the trend in restaurants over the last 20 years is just to make bigger and bigger portions simply because the sort of incremental cost of adding another, you know, two scoops of pasta or whatever was so cheap. And that's changing, you know.
Now, that is really interesting. Talk more about that, because what I think you were just saying is that there's a business model that assumes that a lot of food is going to get thrown away because it's attractive to the customers who know, oh, that restaurant gives big portions. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. I mean, people equate value with huge portions. And for restaurants, you know, you think about the Big Gulp is the great classic example of that at 7-Eleven. And, you know, obviously McDonald's and others had supersized drinks too. You know, they charge a quarter more for, you know, 64 ounces or whatever crazy huge size it is. And the cost for them of that extra soda is pennies because the cost of those ingredients has been so cheap for so long.
Right. And you know what else the soda does? This is a little bit of a tangent. But the soda, because it's sweet, makes you crave more burgers, more fries, more chicken. And I think the soda itself actually makes you eat more food.
Well, that's interesting. But, you know, it's not just soda, obviously. It's, you know, some pasta is a great example. If you go to eat at pasta restaurants, the sizes sometimes could feed four people, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, how many people actually eat that? And what do they do with that when they take that plate away? You know, they're not, I mean, chances are they're tossing in the garbage. So, again, now wheat prices are so high that maybe they'll rethink some of the strategies. Those business models may not work so well anymore.
Andrew Martin, New York Times correspondent, with me on WNYC talking about food waste and referencing the government study that says 27% of food is thrown away in this country, about a pound per person every day. There are organizations that redistribute wasted food. Most of our listeners probably know about City Harvest in the New York City area, for example, that'll pick up from restaurants and banquets and stuff, right?
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, they really make it easy for sort of restaurants and cafeterias. You know, I mean, basically they just need to set aside what's not eaten. And, you know, again, it's not plate. We're not talking plate scraps here. We're talking pans of food that's perfectly good that doesn't get eaten. It's simple for them to cover it and put it in their freezer, and City Harvest will come by and get it. And that's true in most major cities. You know, there's
the national
operations go and pick it up.
Yeah, there's a national umbrella organization called America's Second Harvest, and
that's
they have
right.
branches all over. But this is really influencing, I would imagine, hunger in America, which is hard to measure. And people poo-poo when you say hunger in America. No, there's hunger in Africa. There's not hunger in America, really. But we know that there were shortages last winter at food pantries and soup kitchens in New York City, just
That's
at
right.
the same time that federal funding for those was getting cut. And I imagine as food goes up, people will be more reluctant to give food away than, you know, the normal little individual donations of cans of things and stuff like that. And this is going to get worse for the people who can't afford food the most.
That's exactly right. I mean, as you just mentioned, some of the food, America's Second Harvest told me that their donations are down. You know, people are being, I mean, that's sort of the flip side of this. If you waste less food, there's less food for them. But,
right.
You know, the fact is, I think City Harvest told me that they pick up from 140 locations in New York, 170 locations in New York. And, I mean, think how many food establishments there are in New York City. I mean, there's thousands. So there's still a long way to go, obviously.
Does this go indirectly to the farm bill that just got passed and everybody seems to agree is ridiculous, even though everybody in Congress almost voted for it? You know, because there's grain dumping, which is a common practice to control the market price of that good. That's not in the farm bill, but, you know, food dumping happens country to country, and we're paying people not to grow food in this country. And in a way, it all ties together at the policy level.
It does. And well, and certainly in the past, you're right. I mean, our policy has been to produce low-cost grains to produce cheap food. I mean, we've had a cheap food policy, and you could argue if that's good or bad. But the fact is, you know, for the last 20 years, corn and soybeans in this country, which is a basis of a lot of food, has been very, very cheap.
We had Amanda Taylor on the show last week, who's a freegan, right? So she actually goes what some people call dumpster diving, and gets what she deems to be edible food out of dumpsters, along with other things that people have thrown away that she doesn't like to see wasted. And, you know, that's living on the edge a little bit. So it seems... Go ahead.
I'd say a little bit, yeah.
But it seems to me that there must be some kind of organized response to this, because this whole set of issues that you've raised about, you know, a lot of waste, rising price of food, subsidies for people not to grow, reduced donations to the organizations that give food to hungry people. There must be, short of individual freeganism, there must be some kind of policy response that people are putting on the table. Is there?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote this was because there isn't sort of a national coordinated response to this. I mean, there was an effort to do that in the Clinton administration. They basically had one guy in Washington who tried to coordinate nationally to give this some sort of momentum. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this is to say, you know, hey, food prices are high. There's people that are hungry. Here's a great time to sort of revive something like that and have some coordination. And obviously, America's Second Harvest does that in sort of a private level. But at the government level, you know, it seems like a sort of coordinated effort would do it. There is one thing going on now, which is there was a Good Samaritan bill passed during the Clinton administration that gave companies basically... It basically said if you provide food to food banks and you don't knowingly give bad food, you can't be sued later. And they're trying to extend that now to, you know, further beyond just companies to, I think it's government organizations and charities and that sort of thing.
Andrew Martin, New York Times business correspondent. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We have the great Carl Hiaasen coming up next. Stay tuned. So what did President Bush give up for the Iraq war? Not gas guzzlers, not tax cuts for the wealthy that raided the federal treasury. He gave up golf. Golf. Here is how he said it last week. He revealed it in this interview with Politico.com.
Mr. President, you haven't been golfing in recent years. Is that related to Iraq?
Yeah, it really is. I don't want some mom whose son may have recently died to see the commander-in-chief playing golf. I feel I owe it to the families to be as, you know, to be in solidarity as best as I can with them. And I think, you know, playing golf during a war just sends the wrong signal.
Now, that was in sharp contrast to his juxtaposition of war prowess and golf prowess on the links in 2002.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Heck of a drive. So what is it about golf that it has such symbolism and such a hold on the American male psyche? Well, you probably know Carl Hiaasen as the author of novels like Striptease, Nature Girl, and Skinny Dip, books that gleefully lampoon his home state of Florida, where he's also a columnist for the Miami Herald. But what you may not know is that he is a man enslaved to a ruinous pursuit. He was originally drawn to golf way back when, in his words, quote, Richard Nixon was hunkered like a meth-crazed badger in the White House, Hank Aaron was one dinger shy of Babe Ruth's all-time home run record, and The Who had just released Quadrophenia. But then 32 relatively peaceful years ensued until he got sucked back into the game, and what happened next is the subject of one of his latest books, The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Sport. Carl Hireson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
And you brought your golfing buddy with you. Paul Bogards is the executive director and publicity and media relations at your publisher, Alfred A. Knopf. Hi, Paul.
Brian, how are you? I'm not sure it's a good thing that I'm here. I'm very much his foil, so we'll see what happens.
Well, we will see. Carl, you said on the Colbert Report that for a man, every round of golf is a journey into the darkest part of his soul. Why?
I just think, well, I should speak for men of my age. I think that every round of golf is an adventure, and it often ends badly. You go in with these high hopes and these expectations that you can perform this physical act that you maybe in your when you're 18 or 19 seemed a little easier than it does now. And of course, it's the emotional ups and downs. It's just you're looking at yourself in the mirror and in not a very flattering way. And I wish I had thought of having an excuse to quit as noble as the president. I suspect it might have had something to do with the president's handicap as well as his concern for the it didn't stop him from fishing. It didn't stop him from bush hogging around Texas, but apparently the golf is what he really as an act of valor. I love that.
Yeah, but that does say something about the symbolism of golf to the male psyche, don't you think?
Well, I mean, the symbolism is, you know, I always, people always ask for metaphors, and all of my metaphors, as I said, are surgical metaphors in my case, pain, suffering, long recuperation, various, you know, medical procedures we won't discuss. All those relate to me much more than golf in the way of some sort of patriotic symbolism. I'm not sure there's anything patriotic about it.
No, but I don't know, Paul, what do you think the hold is that golf has on you guys?
I used to think that golf was a humbling sport. Now I've changed my tune a little bit. I think it's humiliating. It's the only sport where you, the more time you spend at it, it seems, the less skill you bring to the table. I started playing like Carl at a very young age, and I too had a long hiatus from the game. And you know, I think one of the things that brings you back to the sport is the quote-unquote solitude that it's supposed to induce. I work in a high-pressure job, and golf is supposed to be an escape for me, but of late it's been anything but an escape for me. It produces more stress than my job.
Well, women golf, too, not at the same rate as men, but you're right, Carl, that golf is different for men than it is for women. Why do you think?
I don't know. I see women having a good time on the golf course, and they chat, and they seem to be, they don't take it as seriously. I think they go out there with reasonable expectations, and the guys, when you put a bunch of guys together, there's a lot of testosterone. I think there's a lot of, and there's betting, serious betting going on. See, I had forgotten in the 32 years that I was away from golf that apparently it's supposed to be a social recreation. You're supposed to play with other people because, you know, being a novelist, all I want to do is go out and be by myself somewhere and be cranky and surly, and I can throw clubs if I want to. I can destroy equipment. I can do all this. But that's not allowed, apparently, or it's frowned on, I should say.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a shock.
Yeah, you know, it is. And when you play with Paul is a kind of a vociferous participant in the game, and his cries echo through the trees mournfully on occasion. But so he lets it out. But a lot of times it's this stoic, you know, this stoic thing where, you know, you stand up and you sink the putt, win the money or lose the money. And the bottom line is you do have to be nice to large numbers of strangers, which no one had warned me about, and I'm not very good at. And it has been a struggle, too. And to put a shabby golf game or a ragged golf game on display for strangers. Paul does it. He plays in these tournaments. He's a real champ. But I mean, it's the most withering experience I can imagine.
It has been said that if you want to see a man's true colors, take him out and play a round of golf with him. And I think there's definitely an element of truth to that. I mean, there are guys who, when they play, you can see them kind of in the rough and improving their lie. That's actually something called cheating.
Yes, we call it cheating.
It is generally frowned upon at the club where I am a member.
But not all clubs by implication. Is that why you call the book The Downhill Lie?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a play on words. Part of the lie is me convincing myself I could go out again after 32 years, even despite all the new equipment, the technology, the advanced, the what they call the hotter golf balls that you can supposedly hit a lot farther. All that, you know, you convince yourself I can go back in my 50s and do something better than I did when I was 18 or 19. And I'm telling you right now, there's very few things that a middle-aged guy can do better in his 50s than he could when he was 18.
Now, wait a minute. Steve in Manhattan.
Speak for yourself there, Carl.
Steve in Manhattan is calling in with an interesting story that puts you young men to shame, I think. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. A great segment. My dad is 90, just turned 90. My mom is 89, and they play golf every day in the summer when it doesn't rain. Although they have switched to weekends because it's too crowded on the weekdays because it's too crowded on the weekends, and they don't like to be rushed.
Well, that's fantastic, and they get along together. The most chilling phone call.
My mom's a better golfer.
That's. I think your dad is very wise in letting that situation exist as it does.
Oh, you think it's up to him, do you?
Well, I know, probably not, but I know that when I was on this, and my relapse that I write about here, the most chilling phone call I got was from my wife one day. I was leaving the golf course, and the phone rang, and a cell phone rang, and she said, guess where I am? And I said, where? And she goes, I'm on my way to have my first golf lesson. And I have to say it was a bone-chilling moment because it's a combustible situation in a marriage. Some couples get along great on the golf course. I mean, they just love it. They go out and they play. Other couples, there's friction, there's tension, there's, especially if neither one is playing particularly well, there's occasionally bloodshed. And in my case, I didn't know how that was going to play out, and my wife very wisely chose to play when I wasn't there.
The thought of my wife taking up the sport of golf fills me with terror.
Really?
Well, I mean, she does everything better than I do. She's smarter than I am. She's an attorney. I can't win an argument with her. I certainly can't beat her at tennis. And if she takes up the sport of golf, I think I'm just going to have to move out.
So you live around here. Carl is from Florida. And there's a great section in Carl's book that describes the two of you playing golf one day near Orlando. And Carl writes that at one point, quote, while probing the underbrush for one of my errant drives, Bogey let out a cry and nimbly founded away from what he claimed was a huge snake. It turned out to be a harmless black racer, no more than 3 feet long, evidently a monster by New Jersey standards. So I would gather that golfing in Florida is a little different than here in the Northeast?
Well, certainly the truthful element of that anecdote in the book is the fact that I spend an awful lot of time marching around the woods. And the last time Carl and I played here in New Jersey, he was a guest at my country club, I'd hit an errant tee shot, and I emerged from the woods, and I asked him this question. I said, am I bleeding? That is never a good question to ask your partner during a round of golf. It suggests that your game is not what it should be.
There was an injury factor because the woods were heavy. The things that scares me about the playing golf up here, Brian, is where I play, there are not a lot of woods, not these heavy, old, you know, ancient forests. And here, I mean, where we play, there's gators, alligators. And you can see an alligator. An alligator's big, and you can see them a long way away. And if your ball goes near the alligator, you pretty much know your next move. But here they have ticks. They have ticks in the woods. And apparently you can get sick, Lyme disease, from these ticks. And if you spend as much time in the woods chasing your ball as I did out at Paul's Club, I mean, I came, first thing you do at the clubhouse is you check yourself for ticks. That's rule number one in northern golf, northeastern golf.
Yeah, so which is to be more afraid of, the snakes or the ticks?
I'll take the snakes any day. I'd much rather have snakes.
Carl Hyacin, Miami Herald columnist, author of many books, including his new one, The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Sport. He's here with Paul Bogards, his golf partner, and a vice president at his publishing company, the company that published this book, Knopf. Now, Carl, a lot of people know you for your other books, and, you know, my kids have read you. I've brought home books of yours from your young adult series for my kids to read. And often there are anti-development and pro-environment themes
yes.
in your book. You link to organizations like Earth Justice and the Everglades Foundation on your own website. But is golf an environment-friendly sport? Can you be both a golfer and an environmentalist?
Well, it started out as that kind of a sport. The tradition of the sport was to be played in nature. The courses were contoured and designed to fit the natural mold of the land, all the water hazards, the trees, everything. They left as much of it intact as they could. The whole idea in the ancient tradition of golf was to be out in the elements, among all the elements of nature. And you're right. Lately, I mean, certainly in my lifetime in Florida, it's become building a golf course has become basically an excuse for another real estate development. And I was very conflicted about it.
Not to mention a boon for the fertilizer industry.
Right, right. And now most of the older, better courses have now gone to a much greener way. You know, they used recycled water. They've really altered the kind of fertilizer. They have to. They can't. You know, they can't sustain that kind of abuse of the land. But the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of atrocious golf developments in Florida and elsewhere. So my goal, of course, is to avoid those places. And I write about some of them in the book. I certainly take my shots at them. But the other sad irony of golfing in a place like South Florida in particular, which is so overdevelopment and so paved over at this point, is that the golf courses have become these little miniature wildlife sanctuaries. The habitat that existed for so many of these wild animals is now paved over. The animals have migrated into, 200, 300 acres of golf course. So you see more wildlife on a typical day on the golf course in Florida than you would really on
sad,
a hike
really.
Through the woods.
That
it is sad, but it's the truth.
We have about 3 minutes left, and you also write about Florida politics, and you follow that. So I want to use the fact that you're here, and you've been on the show before by phone from Florida. I'm glad to have you in the studio today, talking politics. Senator McCain is in Florida right now, and I've been hearing some of the pundits handicap Florida as not being a swing state this year. We all remember Bush versus Gore, but some people are saying Florida is definitely going to go Republican this year. Do you have an opinion about that?
I don't know. I think it's going to be I would bet more on that than I would on it going Democrat. But, you never know.
Why? At the same time that everybody says the country is trending Democrat.
I think Florida is still a very conservative state, especially the I-4 corridor north of. I think South Florida could easily go for Obama, and North Florida could probably go for McCain. It's hard to know what's going to happen in the next few months. And keep in mind also that Obama has done very little campaigning down there. And wherever he goes, a certain energy kicks in. If you saw the scene from Oregon yesterday, 75,000 people showed up. That's more than the Marlins have in their whole 10 games. They don't get that many people. So it's difficult to say what will happen when he hits the ground running in Florida. But I wouldn't, it is a tough state, I think, for a Democrat to win right now.
And what's your take on Florida's Democratic delegates? that's a source of derisive laughter. The Rules Committee of the Democratic National Committee will meet on May 31st next week to consider finally how to count Michigan and Florida in the nomination fight, at all.
It's just funny. Nobody in Florida is clamoring for this at all.
Really?
Forgot about it. We were relieved to be off the hook. For once, we weren't going to be in play after 2000. Anything that would get the limelight off of it. So when they said the primary is not going to count, a lot of us said, that's great. We're off the hook. Now we're getting dragged back into it again. And I think, again, there's no great groundswell. Nobody's marching in the street saying count these delegates except, Hillary's people. But you have to wonder, I don't know why they did this in the first place. The Democrats agreed with the Republican initiative in the Florida legislature to move this primary. There was no resistance to it to speak of, so they can't blame the Republicans for doing this.
They wanted more influence, though.
Yeah, they wanted to move forward. But, I also think the Democratic Party has a uncanny way of shooting itself in the foot. And if they can find a way to screw this up and protract this campaign anymore, I'm certain they'll do that.
Carl Hiaasen's latest book is The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Sport. It is published by Knopf, and Knopf official Paul Bogards, a frequent golfing partner of Carl. Carl also joined us. Thank you both very much.
Thanks Brian.
Take it easy.
And Carl will be reading tonight, I should mention, at 7 p.m. at the Union Square Barnes & Noble, 33 East 17th Street in Manhattan, 7 o'clock tonight.